welcome to live coverage of tonight's DFL Senate candidate debate, coming to you live from the Olva Soccer Fine Arts Center at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. I'm Gary Eichten. Minnesota voters will get a chance this year to elect a U.S. senator. Now, incumbent Republican Rod Grams looks like a shoe-in to be on the November election ballot. Reform Party candidate James Gibson is currently unopposed. He'll probably be listed on the ballot as well. But Minnesota Democrats have a choice to make. There are already five high-profile candidates running for the DFL Senate nomination, and at least two more DFLers are expected to enter the race soon. Tonight, all five of the announced candidates have accepted an invitation from the state DFL party and Minnesota's Democratic Congressional delegation to get together here in Mankato to give those of you here in our audience at Bethany and those of you listening on the radio a better idea of just who they are and what they stand for. Should be a good, lively discussion, and I'm glad all of you were able to join us this evening. Now, a couple of words about tonight's format. The debate will run for 90 minutes. We're going to break this first segment into some general subject areas and give the candidates a chance to discuss the issues among themselves. Then in about a half hour, we'll be taking questions from those of you listening on the radio, those of you here in the audience. And then finally, each candidate will have 2 minutes at the end of the broadcast to make their pitch for your support. As we said, five candidates have joined us this evening, and from my right, they are trial attorney Michael Cerisi, State Senator Jerry Janicich, State Senator Steve Kelly, former U.S. Attorney David Littlehaug, and University of Minnesota physician Steve Miles. Now, one other thing, we do want to have a nice, lively, free-flowing exchange between the candidates, and we would like to keep this as informal as possible, but to accomplish all of that and still help those of you listening on the radio keep track of who's saying what, we've asked all the candidates to regularly identify themselves as we go along, just so you know they don't always talk like that. So it'll sound a little odd, but I think it'll help everybody keep track of who's saying what. Okay, well, let's get started. I thought with the first general area that we'd spend 5 minutes or so talking about is this whole issue of globalization. It's often characterized in the free trade versus fair trade category. Seems like everybody says they support both free trade and fair trade. The question here that I'd like you gentlemen to discuss for a little while is, should we insist that other nations adhere to our labor standards, our environmental standards, and our human rights standards?
I'll start, Gary. David Littlehaug. The central theme of my campaign is respect for individuals, families, and communities in the global economy. There is no question that we are in a global economy, and this isn't really a debate between free trade and protectionism. We know there are going to be rules for trade. The question is going to be, who makes the rules? Is it going to be multinational corporations, or is it going to be the people? And how are the rules going to be applied? Are they going to be applied in secret at the World Trade Organization? Or are they going to be applied through a process where people who care about the environment and human rights and labor standards and food safety are going to have the say? You can tell from my answer what I believe. I believe we need to stand up for individuals, families, and neighborhoods in the global economy.
Well, the question, David, is, and this is Mike Cerisi talking, is how do you inform trade? Too often we have divided ourselves, be it in any given issue, by labels. And so we hear the free trade, fair trade. I think what you're talking about is informed trade. We need to bring to the World Trade Organization, which is a multilateral organization, and also in our bilateral foreign policy negotiations, the issues that you've talked about. We need to talk about, for example, farm policy. Today, we have our farmers in a crisis. And it's simple why they are. There's an oversupply. That oversupply does not come just from the United States. It comes from foreign markets. Why don't we at the World Trade Organization and bilaterally talk about an escrow on an international basis, escrowing land to take them out of production? We can't expect our farmers to do that alone. It's unilateral disarmament. Those are some of the types of things that you need to inform the trade process about. And it doesn't do us much good to argue whether it's free trade or fair trade. It has to be informed trade, and I agree with you that you have to make the process what's called transparent.
I think this is Steve Kelly. I think the mistake that people are making is treating the process of expanding trade as something that's bad for the United States. I think the last few years have demonstrated that Americans as a whole are benefiting from a more open trading system, and the challenge in front of us is to adopt the kinds of policies in the United States that will make sure that everyone, whether they're living on the farm or living in urban Minnesota, benefits from the kind of growth we're getting. And that means to me education policy, job training, the kinds of things that maintain American leadership in this global economy and make sure that nobody gets left behind.
Yes, Steve, but it also means standing up for Americans. For example, when steel is dumped in the United States, that really affects our miners in northern Minnesota.
Well, you know, so it's not David, I've got steel workers who work in my district. And you know what they do? They make circuit boards. And they make circuit boards for Nokia and Ericsson. So what I try to figure out is there is a balance. We do have to protect American steel workers against unfair dumping, but we also have to recognize that we've got union people who are working at good jobs, making good wages by being involved in the international economy.
Well, this is Dr. Miles talking, and I'm one of the few candidates who's actually worked overseas. And I'll tell you, I think that the major thing we need to do is we need to assist other countries in developing their middle class as we develop fair trade. And that means that we have to avoid the hidden subsidies that undermine U.S. markets. For example, if you're allowed to pollute when you're making steel, that's a hidden subsidy that hurts our taconite workers. If you're allowed to exploit child labor, that's a hidden subsidy for labor that produces situations where our workers can't compete. And the United States has not signed on to the Child Labor Agreement. We have not signed on to the Treaty on the Rights of Women. We have not allowed farmers, laborers, and environmentalists to participate directly in the negotiation of our international trade treaties. We have not formed a farmer-owned grain reserve so that farmers can reap the benefit of participating as the primary partners in these international trade agreements. And I think that what we have to do is level the playing field by putting our people in an unsubsidized market, which we're not doing at this time by the types of agreements we're doing.
But we're all saying the same thing. Go ahead, Jerry.
This is Senator Janicich, who happened to be the only candidate here who did go to Seattle and did march for what I believe is a very major issue for our young people, for sure. We in America, I think, can do one of two things. We can sit by idly and watch everything move out of our great country, or we can go out and about and bring the standard that's out there up. We have a choice, I believe. We can idly sit by and have them lower the way we live, or we can go out and bring them to our level. I think it goes back to our parents who went out and did some things against companies to bring our standards of living up. They went on strike. Okay, what do we have today because they did those kinds of things? I think we as a nation and as unions and organizers have to go out into this country and out into third world countries and bring their levels to our levels. Now, if we don't do those kinds of things, I'm convinced that they will bring us to theirs long term and short term. Well, that isn't good for either the farming community, the mining community, or anything else we do in this country.
Jerry, this is Mike Cerisi. It's fine to say those things. The issue is how do you affect that type of change on an international basis?
Hold on, Jerry. The
Iron Range, you have one-third of the workers who used to work up there producing the same amount of iron ore that they produced 20 years ago. That means that there's been technological advancement. Now, what happens to the people who lose those jobs?
Michael,
what are we doing? Just a minute. What are we doing for those people here today? What is our educational system doing? We're all arguing around the fringes here as we talk about how we're going to inform free trade, how we're going to take care of unions, we're going to do all this stuff. Here's the issue facing this country today. We're going to have a surplus. And the issue is, how do we take that surplus and reinvest it in America? This is not about handouts. It's about extending an arm of help.
I want to move on to another area, but quick comments from anybody else here before we do very quick ones.
Well, part of the problem, this is Jerry Janicich again. Michael, part of the problem where in northeastern Minnesota isn't about the technology. part of the problem is the shovels are bigger, the trucks are bigger, and they're taking the resource out at twice the rate. So they do not need.
It's called productivity. Now, how do you put those folks who are put out of work back to work? That's what we need
to
be addressing.
Steve Kelly, I do think we ought to move to incorporate labor and environmental standards into these international labor agreements, but I think we ought to do it with a greater sense of confidence and optimism about the benefits for the U.S.
David Littlehog, did you have anything more to say?
I do, but you want to move on to another topic. Let's do that.
All right. Senate plays a key role in overseeing foreign policy in this country. What standards should the U.S. use to determine when to intervene in a foreign crisis? Should we intervene on humanitarian grounds or simply when our national security is clearly at stake?
This is Dr. Miles talking, and I'd like to address this first. I've spent 20 years working with the American Refugee Committee. I started in Cambodia, and I've gone, last summer I was in Bosnia. This week, the American College of Physicians came out with a document, which I was the major author on economic sanctions. We are a one-world community. Instability in other countries affects us. When India and Pakistan both have the nuclear weapon, that affects us. And nuclear nonproliferation is on our table. When there are human rights abuses in Haiti, they affect us. They show up as boat people. When there is a death, when there are despots in Zaire looting their people, it affects us because this results in a disruption of world trade for the types of minerals that Africa needs to develop and to develop successfully. It's not so simple as saying, what are the criteria when we could evolve? It's a question of what types of institutions will we participate in? And when you look at our record, we are one of the only nations that has refused to sign an international convention on torture, one of the only nations that has refused to sign an international crimes against humanity convention, one of the only nations that has refused to sign a treaty on child labor, one of the holdout nations that wrecked the treaty on comprehensive test ban treating. And we have become isolationists in the way that we are not participating in the world community. And until we engage the world in a leadership role, this kind of question really becomes one that can't be answered.
Well, one of the issues, Mike Cerisi, is, I'm sorry, David, I didn't really hear you. Go ahead.
I want to thank Dr. Miles for some of the humanitarian work that he's done. To answer the question, Gary, I think we ought to have two main criteria. First, how to get a safer world, and second, how we stand up for human rights. On the first criterion, I was appalled that Senator Rod Grams voted against the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Through every administration, we've had bipartisan arms control. And this was a test. The Republican leadership called up this treaty on short notice. Senator Graham said at first he thought the vote should be delayed, but then he voted to force the vote and then voted against it. We've got to stop nuclear proliferation, and certainly the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was a defining vote. And then second, with regard to human rights, we're talking about American opposition to dictators. And we need to be very strong with regards to China. As Dr. Miles pointed out, child labor and slave labor is a big problem with regards to China. And while I want to take a look at the text of the final treaty, I'm very concerned about our decision with regards to the World Trade Organization and China and the bilateral treaty, because I don't think they've changed substantially since Tiananmen Square.
Well, let me address some of the issues that you raised, Gary, because it's easy to talk about the nuclear test ban treaty. I'm sure everybody up on this dais feels the same way about it. The problem is there's 32 conflicts around the world today based on ethnic differences. Where is the United States going to interject itself? And on what principles is it going to interject itself? What is the vital national interest? Some of the issues that you're mentioning, Dr. Miles, go to the humanitarian issues and the education issues are issues that can be dealt with in other international forums. But the problem is, where are we going to invest our foreign policy in the 31 or 32 ethnic conflicts? First of all, we've cut the State Department back drastically. We don't have the eyes and ears on the ground anymore that we used to have. We're not getting that information. So what do we do when there is a problem? We go in after the fact with our military, which is a much more expensive way of dealing with those issues. We have to reinvigorate, I believe, the foreign service and get some money into the State Department and spend our money more wisely there. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves being forced into these conflicts time and time again. We can't afford that. We can't, and our people in the military are not that equipped, and they'll tell you, to deal with those types of issues.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I'll tell you that we currently give 10% as much of our wealth as other countries in Europe to foreign aid, and we just voted another third cut, and we're not repaying our UN debts. And so I totally agree with you. When all you have is a military hammer, somehow everything in the world looks like a nail. But even if we have those tools, we're still going to have to be more willing to engage in multilateral cooperative endeavors with other nations, and that's what we're not doing.
This is Steve Kelly. For me, the issue is what kind of world we're going to leave our kids. For me, I grew up thinking that the Cold War was the way things were going to be for all of my life. And I'm fortunate, I think, to be in a situation where the world is changing rapidly, where we aren't locked into that same conflict that we were locked into before, and it does create real issues for the United States in terms of how we're going to act. I think in terms of thinking about how we're going to leave a better world for our kids, we've got to stand up against genocide. We cannot permit those kinds of humanitarian wrongs to go on. But at the same time, there aren't 31 instances of genocide going on around the world all the time. So there are some kinds of bases for making some decisions.
Sometimes it depends on the color of the genocide, too, as we found in our foreign policy.
Mike, that can be right. But the other thing about this is clear is that, you go to places like the Middle East, and we're trying to put U.S. troops on the ground to try to keep warring parties apart. But the real problem that's going to last a long time there, unless the United States plays a leadership role in fixing it, is the economic disparity between the Israelis and their Arab neighbors. The United States, as the leading economic power in the world, can work to leave a better world for our kids by trying to build up the economies of some of these countries so that they've got a stake in what's going on and don't feel that the only way to get their stake in this is by going to war or by attacking them.
So then, contrary to David, you would deal with China and let them into the World Trade Organization, deal with them on an economic basis, and make sure that economically their people are bettering themselves. I think that's probably where you and I may be on one side and David may be on the other. I think we have to engage these countries on an economic basis while at the same time working on human rights and on child labor issues.
Well, Senator Janicich, you want to weigh in here before we move on?
That's part of the problem when you're with all these attorneys.
If
there was one more, I'd never get a word in edgewise.
But I'm not an attorney.
I said three.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't know Steve Kelly was.
My country's a leader. It doesn't use food as a weapon. It takes care of its people who serve it. Currently, what we're doing with our military is a shame. We wonder why we have nobody who wants to be a part of it. We refuse to pay them. We refuse to give them the tools they need. We in this country should start taking a good hard look at what we think is important. If and when we get involved in anything that's military, the UN is there, and we should use it. We should lead and use other parts of this world when we do anything. That's why it's there.
And Jerry David Lillehaug, I agree with you. And two of the most shining moments of American foreign policy have been the Marshall Plan and the Food for Peace program. We're right in the middle of farm country tonight. Food need not be a weapon. It can be a way of advancing human rights and dealing with human dignity and helping people around the world.
Okay, on the farm front, we are, Mr. Lillehaug noted, in the middle of farm country, close to some of the richest farmland in the world, actually. Now, people used to be upset with the old farm policy. that the U.S. had for years and years, saying ultimately it hurt farmers and cost taxpayers too much. So they switched to the Freedom to Farm Bill, which was supposed to end the subsidies to farmers. But now critics say it's hurting farmers and costing taxpayers too much. So what's supposed to be done about the farm crisis?
Well, let's first, the farm crisis is part of the rural crisis. We need to address this issue. We're going to have a surplus. Now, the Republicans, of course, want to give it back to the wealthiest. They want it, Bush's plan to give on average to the top 1% of the taxpayers $50,000 a year. The bottom 20% will get $50 a year. First of all, we have to decide, do we want to take some of our money in this country and reinvest and revitalize rural America? If the answer to that is yes, then you have to support the farmers because they are the backbone of the rural economy. And we can do it. We can give them support in prices. We can have an expanded CRP. We can tell them we're going to give you a level playing field when you negotiate with very powerful interests. We're going to extend your loan repayment so that when I go to the table to negotiate, they don't know that I have to pay off my loan tomorrow. Extend it out maybe 36 months. We can talk about the CRP, as I mentioned. We can talk about going on an international basis and talk about escrowing land. These are the things we have to do to get the farmers back. They don't want a handout. They want an ability to compete. And if you start revitalizing rural America, what do you do in the cities? You have less transportation problems. You have less education problems. You have less pollution problems. And if you have an expanded CRP, you can help with the environment. You do it in environmentally sensitive areas. You do it in the river valleys. You do it in water plains. These are the things that need to be done, and that's going to be a big issue. I saw projections just the other day that in 100 years we're going to have double the population in this country. Where are they going to be? All in the cities? It's impossible.
But, Mike, the focusing just on the agricultural part of this, I think, ignores something that people in rural parts of Minnesota are saying, which is that we need both an attention to preserving the family farm and to doing things like supporting second-generation co-ops and value-added production in farm country. But we also need other kinds of economic activity in our rural areas, because the studies have shown that over a long-term period, regardless of where farm prices are, rural areas are poorer than other areas. And the only way we can change that is by adding new components to the rural economy. And Mankato is a terrific example, because in Mankato, people here have been working on a wireless technology initiative that involves the tech college and the state university, and trying to broaden that out to the schools and give kids some excitement about studying math and science, because it's relevant to things that they might do in their lives. Those are the kinds of things that give options, choices to people who live in rural areas, so the kids don't have to move off the farm.
And you know, we could. This is Dr. Miles speaking. You know, we could
say one thing.
You know,
let me.
You already said one.
But let me say. Then let me say two.
You're overruled, counselor.
Let me say two. Only Gary can overrule. Let me say two. In order to do that, you have to have a broad-based revitalization program for the rural areas. Transportation, technology, the schools that we have here, the state colleges and everything. You know, education is not just K through 12, it's pre-K through 65. You have to get back in and give people the tools to revitalize the economy.
You know, I'll tell you, we couldn't think of a better way to wreck the family farm than what we're doing now. What we can do now is we lock the farmers out of international trade agreements. We insist they sell their food overseas through large corporations instead of through their own farmer-controlled national grain trusts. We have a short loan period that's shorter than one crop cycle. We extend price supports across the entire unit of production rather than targeting them to the first, say, 1,500 acres or 2,000 acres to assure that we aren't subsidizing large corporations. And what happens with that? We create overproduction, which drives down prices and sends farmers straight into corporations. We need to say, first of all, that we value family farms. We value them because they're efficient. We value them because They are the group that is the best at environmental conservation. They are the best place to raise kids in the state because they train kids how to run small businesses, and they are great for our food processing industry. Yes, we have to have rural economic development, and the Rural Economic Development Trust Fund in the Freedom to Farm Act was funded by the Republicans for $0.00. But we also have to move all those price supports down to the first unit of production, put farmers on international trade agreements, and also we have to address health insurance. I've talked to a half a dozen farmers in the last 2 weeks alone who have quit farming because they're paying $4,000 a year for health insurance, and they decide they'd rather be insured and walk away from the farm. And that's
a sin. But you know what they have to insure? Yeah. Steve, you know what they have to insure? They have to insure the hogs in case you lose them.
Well,
but the first thing that goes is life insurance. Then health insurance goes. Then, you know, but they have to insure the hogs. Isn't that amazing?
You know, you guys, Rod Grams has done this state a disservice.
No fool.
Plain and simple. Plain and simple. He's done us a disservice. We have choices. Anybody here believe, and in this state and in this country, believe that we do not support farming? We support farming. Tax dollars support farming. It's just, who do we want to support? Do we want to support the family farm, or do we want to support agribusiness? There's a difference. There's a difference. And currently what's going on in this state and in this country, we're supporting a lot different, and we're giving mouth service and rhetoric.
David,
for the family farm.
Okay, David Littlehog,
that's exactly right, and we've got to put this in context. We're seeing a disturbing rush toward consolidation through a number of our key industries as they become multinational, not just agriculture, but banking, energy, transportation, and telecommunications. And we need to ask the question, do we want four grain companies and four packing companies controlling the lives of Minnesota farmers? Or are they going to be indentured servants in the new global economy? I believe they're entitled to respect in the global economy, and I'm prepared to stand up for farmers.
Okay. I want to get some questions from the audience, from our radio audience as well, but I have one more for you fellas to talk about briefly. Senator Grams has suggested that with the budget surplus that's building up, we should devote, the federal government should devote a good share of that surplus to a cross-the-board significant tax cut. Give it back to the people who paid it. Would you agree? Can we afford that?
I disagree.
Rod Grams is nuts.
I disagree. This Mike's.
I mean, anybody. This is State Senator Jerry Janisich. Rod Grams is nuts. Think about this. My mom and dad, 82 and 78, every year worrying about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. That's insane. That should be taken care of, and it should be done now. We have nationwide and Minnesota a housing shortage. Big. Third graders know enough that we provide good food and a house and a good job and a good education. Before you start giving money back and cutting taxes, you take care of the promises we've made to our people, and you deliver on them.
Well, we don't even know if there's going to be... This is Mike Cerisi talking. We don't even know if there is going to be a surplus. We don't know that. 7 years ago, they were projecting large, large deficits. Now we're projecting large surpluses. So if there's going to be a surplus, we need to have a debate in this country as to where we're going to reinvest those dollars. First of all, if there's going to be a tax cut, any money devoted to a tax cut, and by the way, Democrats in Congress are saying we ought to have a tax cut. Okay? Where is the tax cut going to go? I would suggest the first place it go is to reduce the debt. If you reduce the debt, you have cheaper mortgages. You have cheaper home loans. You have cheaper car loans. You have cheaper student loans. You have cheaper revolving credit loans. And you know what that is? That's a tax cut for the working person. The Republicans want a tax cut. They first suggest $752 billion, then it went to $800 billion. That would go to
they
the
spend
most...
spend it faster than we can make it,
wait a minute. That goes to the highest taxpayers. And the reason for that is simple, folks. Let's not kid ourselves. The wealthiest people in this country pay the most taxes. So the Republicans want to give it back to them.
How wealthy are you, Mike?
Does that make a difference? Now, see, that's the type of thing, Steve. That's Steve Miles said that.
I said that.
Yeah. And, I'm sort of tired. That's one of the reasons I'm running. I get a little tired of people dividing people in this country.
Mike,
So just a minute. You said it, so I'm going to respond. There's more things that join us together, all of us in the country. Poor, wealthy, black, white, Jewish, Catholic, Lutheran, Protestant, than there are that separate us. And when politicians start understanding that and start addressing the issues that join us together, we will be better off as a country. I'm probably wealthier than you, Steve.
Let me finish. Yeah, you've had a long time.
Oh, no, hold on. So what we're going to do with a tax cut is give it to the people. But before we do that, we have to reinvest. You're all talking about all these things the government should do. Where's the money going to come from? There's priorities
here. Dr. Miles?
Yes, I'll tell you. You know, in the paper this morning, there was another article where people in the top fifth of the income spread got another 15%, and people in the bottom fifth got 1% over the last decade. Now, what this represents is we're not in the same boat. What that spread represents is a loss of opportunity. Because when you don't have an opportunity for health care, and one-fourth of the population between 25 and 65 don't have health care insurance, you lose job opportunities because you get sick. And when you don't have an opportunity for education, and the costs of post-secondary education are rising three times faster than inflation, then you drop down to the bottom of the economic ladder, you can't educate your kids as well, and your kids are more likely to get into trouble. I wish we were in the same boat. But you know, the last tax cut that Rod Graham signed on to gave 1,200 times the size tax cut to people over $660,000 a year than it did to people under $60,000. And now...
Okay.
Now we've got the debt's gone from $4.4 trillion to $6.4 trillion, and he wants to end estate taxes for the rich and privatize Social Security so that our children will inherit debt and the estates of the rich will go on.
So we're all in agreement.
Not putting us in the same boat.
I didn't say everybody was in the same boat as to their standard of living. I said that you shouldn't divide people.
I'm not divided.
Divide people. That's what I said.
Senator Kelly,
you,
David Lillehug.
Let me say one thing.
I might get a word in edgewise,
like
Mike.
This is kind of fun.
This is Steve Kelly. You know, I think Steve Miles' last comment leads us into the real issue here, which is why Senator Grahams wants to rob our kids in order to stay in power in this election cycle by giving people a bribe in the form of a tax cut. Instead of thinking about what kind of economy, what kind of world we're going to leave our kids, he's focused on how to stay in power. And he thinks the way to do it is by talking about a tax cut, but that's wrong. The right way to do this is talk about the things that are important to people, and that includes Social Security. And we ought not be leaving our kids the debt of Social Security. We ought not be leaving them a national debt. And there are some other debts that we're at risk of leaving them, including an environmental debt. We ought to be using that surplus, if it materializes, to make sure that our kids aren't paying the same burden today for us when we retire as we're trying to pay for our parents as they're retired. We ought to figure out a way to reduce that burden in the future.
David Lillehug?
You know, Mike, we're going to try to be courteous to each other and let everybody speak here, and I appreciate that. Let's understand why this is happening, why we've got the disparity in wealth and power and influence, and why there are all these proposals for unfair tax cuts, and why CEOs are making 420 times more than the average production worker. I submit part of it is because we need campaign finance reform.
Absolutely.
This is how the electoral process works. You talk for many hours a day to people who are in the upper 1-5% of income in this country. And the average person, families, individuals, working families, for them, giving money is an unnatural act. We need campaign finance reform, and the alternative is not just to have rich people run and pay their own campaigns. The alternative is not, as Congressman Penny wants to do, to lift the cap on expenditures and let anybody contribute whatever they want to. We've got to get at the fundamental source of inequality and wealth and power in this country, and campaign finance is a darn good start.
Well, the question,
I think, Senator,
question dealt with tax cuts. and whether or not we had a tax cut, and you went to campaign reform.
But if we could stay on that for one second, that would be good.
Why we have Gucci gulps, why those lobbyists are hanging out there. Whenever a tax bill comes through, that's why you get the big loopholes, and that's why average people get socked.
Currently in the United States Senate, 20 out of 100, count in this room, 20 of you out of 100 would have an income a year of $2.4 million. 20 of you.
Wow.
This is Jerry Janicich. I don't come close. my guess.
Yeah, but we'd all be getting at least you and I would be getting a pay raise.
A big one.
Big raise.
My guess is, nobody in this room is even close to that. Campaign finance is a big deal for all of us. Somehow, some way, if we don't pay attention here, low to moderate to middle income people will never be able to run. That's pretty much why I believe the endorsement process is the only way to go. If that process no longer exists, I don't get to be here. And if I can't be here, that means most of your children won't be able to be here.
All right, let's...
Let me respond. I think that it'd be appropriate that I respond to that. Because, sure, Jerry. I know. I know it wasn't. But there is one person in the room who did make more than that. And this person in the room came from rather modest means. This person in the room, his grandfather, was an immigrant. His father went to the seventh grade. His mother died when he was in seventh grade. He learned the value of education, of working hard, and he achieved the American dream. And you're suggesting that people like that are not entitled to run. And you turn it from an issue that was a tax cut, and you turn that into not so subtle. And see, this is one of the reasons I did get involved in politics, because people in politics tend to do that type of stuff. I don't think...
Mike, where's your evidence? Let me finish. The issue is a tax cut.
And who gets the tax cut? The tax cut go to the working people if we're going to have a tax cut.
Okay.
I don't think anybody at this table disagrees with that. And we should use the rest of the surplus to reinvest in America to give people the tools to achieve their greatest dreams. That's what we should do.
All right. If you just joined us, I'm Gary Eichten. We're broadcasting live this evening from Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. Five of the DFL party's candidates for the U.S. Senate, a seat that's currently held by Republican Rod Grams, have gathered here at the Ilva Soccer Fine Arts Center to debate the issues. In March, DFLers will begin the process of deciding which candidate they want to represent the party in the November general election. The candidates who've joined us this evening include trial attorney Michael Cerisi, former U.S. Attorney David Lillehog, state senators Jerry Janicich and Steve Kelly, and University of Minnesota physician Steve Miles. Time now for questions from those of you in the audience, either here at Bethany or on the radio. Those of you in the audience, if you do have a question for the candidates, just raise your hand, and Len Witt or Tony Boll will get a mic to you. Those of you listening on the radio, all you have to do is dial in the Twin Cities. Number to call is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828. Now, one thing we ask, and it might be more difficult here in the audience than it will be on the radio, if you're actively working for one of the candidates, we're asking you not to raise your hand and don't call in, because we'd like to get let some other undecided people get their questions answered. So, again, if you're calling in with your question, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And, Tony, why don't you go ahead?
My name is Dick Liebendorfer. I'm a resident of Mankato. I'd like to make a couple of very quick remarks and then ask a question. Based on those remarks, I'd direct the question to all of you. The Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad is planning an expansion through southern Minnesota, going through Mankato and any number of other cities in southern Minnesota. In Mankato, it's going to run through neighborhoods where there are approximately 1,500 people or more immediately adjacent to the tracks. About 14% of Mankato's affordable housing is located immediately adjacent to the tracks. Amongst the environmental effects are the effects of diesel exhaust. Federal studies show that diesel exhaust affects air quality.
Okay, your question?
My question is, what are you going to do to stop the expansion?
This is David Lillehaug. We need a second senator like Paul Wellstone to weigh in with the Surface Transportation Board and tell the DM&E Railroad that they have done it exactly backwards. First, you go out and you talk to people in the neighborhoods, and you find out what they want and how you work with them, and then you plan accordingly. They have done just the opposite. They poked a finger in the eye of many, many neighborhoods around the state, and not just here in Mankato, but all the way to Rochester as well. What we're looking at is 40 coal trains, high-speed coal trains a day coming through Minnesota, and very significant environmental impacts, real disruption to neighborhoods, and in fact, in Rochester near the Mayo Clinic, some very serious consequences in terms of emergency vehicles getting to the hospitals. And what is this all about? So we can increase the use of coal in an environmentally sensitive area of Wyoming. This DM&E has to be told by both United States senators in no uncertain terms, you're not coming through here until you clean up your act.
I take a different approach. Coal is Charles Dickens' fuel. This track is a 150-year investment in coal. Coal is yesterday's fuel. It poses unacceptable problems at the site where it's extracted. It is the source of 50% of the lead in the air, which is now is recognized as a major toxin to the brain. It is a source of a huge amount of mercury. We should be shifting to natural gas, a more aggressive conservation, aggressive alternative fuels. I think the coal train should be, frankly, just scrapped. We should natural gasify these plants. We should develop whatever natural gas pipelines are needed as an interim to proceeding towards hydrogen fuel development. I feel that it's not the problem with the siting. It's not the problem with how it goes through the neighborhood, but it's an additional investment in the infrastructure of a fuel that, from the standpoint of global warming, from the standpoint of the environment, at both the source and the use, we can no longer afford to have.
Well, I would ask then, what would you say to the coal miners, and who's going to finance the transfer?
Well, I think
what we have to do is along the lines that David Lillehaug said. There's just absolutely no question that you cannot impose these types of burdens on communities, particularly where you have, as this gentleman suggested, 14% of the affordable housing in Mankato. Not just the environmental, the risk of injury, all the issues that arise from that. And you need to do it through an informed discussion between the companies and the citizens. If you just say, Steve, that you're going to stop coal, then you have to have a solution.
No, I didn't say stop coal. I say we continue the present coal, but we don't add to the coal infrastructure.
Well, this is Steve Kelly. I think the question's a good one because it does ask us to talk about a little bit broader issues, where this fits into our approach to government. And I agree with Steve that we ought to be moving away from coal as rapidly as possible. But the angle I take on this is a little bit different, that what we're talking about here is the balance between the national government and policies established to encourage railroads at the national level and the concerns of local communities, the city of Mankato and all the communities along the rail line. And we need a U.S. senator who's going to fight for rebalancing the role of local communities against the role of the national government, because people need to know that they can have a voice in what happens locally that has real impact and will be listened to in Washington. And that's the kind of U.S. senator I'll be.
Senator Janicich, you want to comment, Chris?
State Senator Jerry Janicich, maybe a common sense approach. You know, rail, we do move a lot of product with rail. So for us not to think that rail isn't important to us is a big mistake.
We move farm products all the time in this state and in this country by rail. There was a point at one time where most of us would have begged for rail anywhere near us because it would have meant we would have grown, particularly in a lot of our areas in rural Minnesota. So I think you have to sit down and you have to bang out something that makes some sense. And we are a pretty bright civilization.
Okay, let's go over here for another question. Go ahead, please.
I'm David Thompson. I work here at the college. And first of all, I would like to commend you gentlemen for coming on to Bethany Lutheran College campus, because as you probably know, we are generally quite conservative here. And so let me go to, especially on the social issue, so let me go right away to what is probably still the most controversial social issue. And I want to ask you a question that I have found that pro-choicers usually do not answer. And I'm assuming that all of you are at this point. I haven't heard otherwise. The question I have for you, and I want to pin you to the wall, and Gary, I want to make sure that you make sure they answer it.
I'll try.
Okay. In an abortion, what is it that is being aborted? Is it a person? Is it something less than a person? Is it a living human life? What is it? Because that is, in fact, a very key issue in this whole discussion.
Okay, well, this should require a short answer from each person. Where do we want to start? Who wants to start?
Nobody's raising their hand.
Dr. Miles, why don't you start?
I'll start. There's not a short answer, because I think that the abortion debate's been plagued by short answers. Pro-choice and anti-abortion, I think, are the worst short answers we have. The first part of my answer is I'm going to say that I'm a foster parent to a disabled child. We adopted a child who had fetal alcohol syndrome. When she came to us at 4 and a half, she could not stack one block on top of another. And thanks to special education and the type of health care that we could afford, Erica is now a student at Southwest State University. That is a pro-child policy. Now, we have in the United States 1/5 of our kids in poverty, 11.5 million without insurance, a third of the homeless people in Minnesota are kids. That's not a pro-child society. And to address the policy of abortion, what we need to do is we need to make every child a wanted child. And to my mind, hair splitting on the question of what is a fetus, is it a life or not, seems to me to put the question wrong. Have we created a society that welcomes and loves children into the debate? And I would feel very comfortable if every person in this room would put their family on the line, not just with a perfect child, but with a disabled child.
But do you have a...
Go into our institution.
Would you answer his question?
Sure. I'm pro-choice. I don't believe that any government policy has a doctor. I don't see any government policy has ever improved any decision between a doctor and their patients.
But what is being aborted when there's an abortion?
Here's my answer, Gary. This is Steve Kelly. I don't know the answer to that question for myself personally, but I am quite clear that the government doesn't know that answer either, and it ought not be imposing its view of that answer on the mother, on the family, on the relationship between the mother, the physician-patient relationship. That's what we clearly ought not do in the United States.
Okay, who's next?
This is Mike Cerisi. This is an issue, and I agree with Dr. Miles on this. It's not an issue that is, and is it Mr. Thompson? Yes. It's not an issue that can be answered with a short answer. This issue has so divided America, and not just since Roe versus Wade, it was before then. And we have had a desire on the part of some people to impose their sense and their decision on this issue based, I think, in large part on religious beliefs on others. That's not what this country is about. This country is made up of Jews, Catholics, Protestants, Calvinists, atheists,
people feel different on this issue. And while you can try to impose or inform the public morality, you can't impose your sense of morality on someone else. That's what this country's about. But what we can do, I think, are address the issues that Dr. Miles talked about.
But
we can join. Let me say this.
I understand but the question is a fairly straight ahead question.
No, the question is, what is it? And I agree with Steve. I mean, some people believe it's a life. Others do not believe it's a life. Some doctors cannot answer that question. Those who believe it's a life, that's why they feel so intensely about that issue.
Okay.
But put that aside, can't we join hands across that gulf and say, how about prenatal care? How about women who are abused? How about health care? How about taking care of the children when they are born?
Senator Janicich?
We join issues on that? That's what I think we have to be doing.
Senator Janicich?
Gary, I'm a choice, have been. I'm not smart enough to understand what point. But the one thing I am smart enough to know is that in 1982, 83, when I ran for the first time for public office, and I had this discussion with my mother, she said, it's no damn business, Jerry, of yours. I'm smart enough to understand that.
David Lillehog?
I think that's been what the definition is pretty well covered. I'm strongly pro-choice, but I'd like to make a little larger point. We appreciate Bethany Lutheran hosting this tonight. We're in Ylvisaker Hall, which is, I think, the only Norwegian name longer than mine. But what is going on in the Republican Party in terms of the issue of tolerance on the issue of choice is something that's very troublesome, and that's why people like Dean Johnson and Judy Dutcher are leaving the party. That's right. And why the DFL party is doing so well. And I believe all of us are on this stage united in favor of a woman's right to choose, and we will take that to the people.
But I'd like to add one more thing to that, because I think the debate is, frankly, impoverished if it comes down to a straight-up question of whether society is majority choice or not on the abortion debate. Because I think that the question is that the people who are against abortion have much to teach us about the question of how we think about and value life. And it extends to issues like physician-assisted suicide, which I am opposed to, which I have learned a great deal from the pro-life perspective. And it extends to the issue of capital punishment, which I am opposed to, because what I have learned from my pro-life friends. And this is a very complex question. And just because I can't answer your specific question on that aspect of it does not mean that the larger questions and values that are entered into this debate or created by this debate by those who are against abortion, I think, have a clear role in the public discussion.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a caller from Minneapolis. Steve, your question, please.
Hi. My question's pertaining to, I believe it was mentioned earlier, Mr. Cerisi mentioned about morality and how we have to be more accepting of other people. My question is a basic general question to everyone regarding religion. And you hear a lot about Bradley and Gore talking about bringing religion back into the party, et cetera, et cetera. My biggest concern is alienating people that have strong democratic feelings that don't have religion, that don't refer to God as an all-encompassing anything. Isn't it discriminatory to say, in God we trust on the $1 bill God mentioned throughout the Constitution? My question is, what do you plan to do as a senator to eliminate God in any form of governmental writings, literature, saying the Pledge of Allegiance, etc.?
That's a good issue.
Any one of you going to make that a central part of your...
This is Mike Cerisi. I wouldn't presume to attempt to eliminate God.
This is Steve Miles during the Monica Lewinsky debate. I wish the House of Representatives had put the Ten Commandments on their own wall.
All right. Let's go back to another caller's on the... David Little.
You know, there is a serious issue underlying that question, and that is, what is to be the role of religion in politics? And thus far, the religious right seems to have claimed that, and I don't believe that's correct or positive. I think our religious beliefs very much inform our moral beliefs, and as part of our campaign, We're reaching out to progressive people in a number of religious and faith communities. And one thing I think we have learned through the last year, is without violating the principle of church and state, separation of church and state, there are a lot of things that faith communities can do in our neighborhoods. I worked with a number of faith communities in the Phillips neighborhood when I was the United States Attorney. And we needed them in the same way we needed neighborhood associations, cops on the beat, social workers, and so on, to reduce crime and violence in one of the lowest income, highest crime areas of Minnesota. And I value the work of churches like Our Savior's Lutheran and other churches within the Phillips and other neighborhoods. And we don't want to abdicate values and morality to the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, I agree that this is Steve Kelly, and I do agree that there is a serious issue there, and my take on it comes from I served in the Minnesota House of Representatives, and over the arch of the House there's a description attributed to Patrick Henry, which isn't exactly from him, but it talks about one of the critical virtues in a democratic society being tolerance. And I think we all need a greater sense of tolerance. If you are not religious, you need to be tolerant of religious people. And if you are religious, you ought to be tolerant of other religions and non-religious people. I think that's the principle the United States was built on. And so it is anti-purist in its approach. So people who are looking for somebody to be 100% pure, I think, are asking for the wrong thing in the United States. I think we need a little bit more tolerance in how we approach these issues.
Okay. Let's go over here. Len?
Hi, I'm David Mingy, U.S. Congressman in the 2nd District.
Uh-oh.
I'd like to thank folks for participating tonight and state that paying for prescription drugs is an enormous struggle for millions of Americans. What do you propose about this particular problem as a solution?
David, this is David Lillehaug, and I really appreciate the question and you hosting the debate tonight. We only need to look at this morning's paper to see that what is happening in the prescription drug industry is the same that's happening in agriculture and banking and energy and transportation and last week in telecommunications with the Time Warner AOL merger announcement. Two of the big drug companies coming together, and once again, what happens when you get a monopoly? Prices go up, service and product quality goes down, and working people get the shaft. We need to enforce our antitrust laws to make sure that in the prescription drug industries, consumers do not get the short end of the stick. Number two, as I travel around the state, I talk to a lot of seniors. And this is true certainly outside of Minnesota as well. At the end of the month, many seniors still need to make the choice between buying the prescription medication and eating. And in a country where the Dow Jones Industrial Average is 11,000 points, that is obscene. We've really got to extend Medicare to prescription medication. And then finally, we got to make sure that the drug companies don't take advantage of the goodwill of American consumers. A recent study showed that a prescription costing $100 in Minnesota, in the United States, only costs $50 to $60 in a number of other countries around the world, including across the border in Canada. We need to sit down with these drug company executives and say, you're going to treat American consumers, American senior citizens, at least as well as you do people in other countries.
No. This is Steve Miles. You know, I'm a doc, and Minnesota just passed a new limited health insurance policy that's specifically targeted at diabetics. And I'll tell you something. Diabetes is one of those diseases where we happen to know that if you treat these patients with medications that run about $800 a year, you can decrease the likelihood their kidneys will fail. And so we've taken the penny-wise and pound-foolish approach, and we'll be putting these people on dialysis soon, $20,000, $40,000, $60,000 a year. The problem is that Medicare was designed as a hospital care system when people were not faced with living with chronic disease. And it is chronic disease and chronic disability that we now must recenter the Medicare system on, and we have not made that shift. And so it's not simply a matter of adding prescription costs, but it's also adding community services, adding adaptive aids to enable people to live more successfully with the types of chronic diseases they now have. It's also not as simple as large corporations. Janssen Corporation, which is one of the smaller drug houses, sells a drug that deworms pigs and treats cancer in humans. The cancer research in humans was all paid for by taxpayers, and they charge 170 times as much for the same dose form for humans as for pigs. The U.S. government has erected a trade embargo to protect drug company products. You can't import them. Pharmacies can't order from overseas. It's wrong. Paul, you're right. I see Paul Wellstone sitting out there in the audience, unless there's another bearded hippie type looking out there. Paul, you're right. There's no reason we should have a trade embargo to protect drug company products. It's our country, not theirs. Okay. And we got to fix it.
All right. You gentlemen will weigh in, too?
Yep. Could we? First of all, currently I think about, first of all, our seniors, and there are places in this country that Medicare and Medicaid do pay for their drugs. That should be part of making that promise whole that I talked about earlier. Then I think about my dad as a veteran. And my dad as a veteran, if he accesses Hibbing Hospital, he pays full price for his drugs. But if I can get him to Duluth or St. Cloud or St. Paul at VA hospitals, he has a copay. So I think as a society, we should make those, the St. Paul, the St. Cloud, or Superior, make them outlets so that any veteran in rural Minnesota who wants access by a phone call can use that process and get that drug within, my guess is, 12 to 14 hours. Okay. The third thing is Minnesota, and I and Senator Kelly here have both been a part of, we have a new program. We put $20 million into a drug, a prescription drug program that's income sensitive. And for our seniors who are out there listening, I want you to know that there is a program that does exist. Currently, it is not being accessed like it should be. We have way more money than we have applicants. So please apply. And what we will also be doing, I think, this year, we do have a income guideline that might be just a little too low. So our goal this session will be to pop that goal up.
All right.
Okay. Jerry, may I respond?
First of all, I think probably I'm the only one here who has had to pay health care benefits for employees.
That's not true. I pay them for my campaign staff.
Well, okay, other than campaign staff. I'm talking about...
I'm the only candidate who does.
In a business.
No, that's not true, Steve.
In a business, all right? The drug portion of health care premiums is driving the increases today. Our insurance premiums went up 24%. You see among teachers, they're going up between 24 and 66%. We pay for those employees. What are you going to do with drug companies? I'm probably also the only one up here who has taken on a number of drug companies on issues such as this. First of all, what about most favored nation? Why should people on Medicare not get the cheapest price that the drug company offers? Why shouldn't that be part of the programs we have? Secondly, the formulas on which they allocate Medicare money in this country are totally out of proportion. People in Florida get $3,000 or $4,000 for gap insurance and other things, and in here, the senior citizens in Minnesota have to pay it. Those issues need to be addressed. And finally, we do need to take a look at some of the laws that are on the books and enforce them against the companies. But you know something, David, you're not going to stop, and nor should you in every case, stop consolidations among companies. Sometimes they're good, but they need to be more vigorous. The laws that we do have on the books need to be more vigorously enforced with respect to antitrust issues. So there's a number of things you can do here. But again, the cost of drugs is the largest escalating component of health care costs today.
Senator Kelly, last word here before we move to the next.
I agree we ought to add prescription drugs to Medicare. I agree we have to fix the inequity between Minnesota and other states and the fact that we have a Republican congressman when a Republican Congress is in control who can't solve that problem is another reason we need to get rid of Senator Rod Grams. I'm going to bring a little different twist to this, something Steve mentioned. You know, the United States funds a lot of this research that the drug companies keep pointing to when they say this is why the prices have to be this high. The United States ought to take a stake in this so that we can hold the prices down on research that we pay for. You know, the University of Minnesota is going to get some benefit out of a drug that it discovered and yield a legacy for our kids from that. The United States ought to be benefiting from it. Our patients ought to be benefiting from it, and we ought to have lower prices from as a result of the research that the United States is sponsoring.
Okay, it'd be nice to get at least two more questions on before we wrap up, and that means we've got to take care of each one of these in about 5 minutes, no more than that. Let's go over here, Lan.
My name is Barb King, and I'm from Minneapolis, and I'm sure that all of you, each and every one of you, care about the environment. I'd like to know from each and every one of you, what are you doing about the environment to protect it?
Okay, that's a quick comment from each one of you.
Yeah, please. I'd be happy to start. I trust you're asking about what we've done in the past about the environment. Well, as the United States Attorney, the Chief Federal Prosecutor for Minnesota, I was the best U.S. Attorney for the environment in Minnesota history, and just down the river from here in Blue Earth, Minnesota, I negotiated the largest criminal pollution settlement in Minnesota history, $4 million. Of that amount, I made sure that $1 million went back to the community to improve sewage systems and reduce non-point source pollution.
Okay.
And I could go on, but now I'm focusing especially on confined animal feeding operations. Did you know, right up the road from here, not far from Gustavus Adolphus College, they want to put in a big feedlot. And this is not just harmful from an environmental standpoint. It's this kind of thing that's killing the family farmer. And we've got to enforce our environmental laws.
Who's next?
I'm State Senator Jerry Janosich, and I introduced a bill last week, a legacy bill. And what it does is capture $192 million of the surplus. Minnesotans like their water, they like their land, they like to fish, they like to hunt. They do all those things every weekend. All you have to do is be out on I-35 and you see where we're headed. And the goal in this legacy bill will be to use this money to put it into the Minnesota River, into RIM, into programs and initiatives that are currently successful for our state, and doubling it up with the idea that 10 years from now, we've made a good investment.
Next.
This is Mike Cerisi. You've asked what we did do, and I assume you also, Ms. King, want to know what we will do. First of all, the environment must be on the forefront of this country's priorities. We need to pass down clean air, clean water to our children. What I've done is I have been involved in cases in my career involving the environment. The most recent was a clean air gasoline that was a patent case that I handled in California and tried over a period of 5 months. So I have been involved in environmental issues, and as a senator, I will continue to be involved in environmental issues. And I think we need to look at components like that when we deal with other problems, such as the farm problems, and we talk about the CRP problem. There we can get a bigger bang for our buck by taking a look at environmental issues while at the same time helping put in place components to solve the farm problem.
Next.
I think one of the biggest environmental challenges that we're facing is the question of energy. And it's critical to me, and one of the things that I've worked on as a state representative and a state senator is make sure we are moving to renewable, sustainable sources of energy so that we aren't leaving our kids the kind of dirty energy sources that we've already talked about tonight. And I've supported efforts to enable environmental groups to intervene in those actions by our regulatory agencies to make sure that the environmental voice is heard when decisions on energy production are being made.
My major life contributions have been in healthcare, senior care, and education, but throughout my life, we have belonged to Friends of the Mississippi, Sierra Club, Clean Water Action, Greenpeace, and are now actively working on urban housing issues. I think one of the things we need in the Senate is more professional diversity. Many of the environmental questions involve the ability to interpret scientific information, And if you look at the way that Congress shilly-shallied around global warming, many of those people simply were not qualified to evaluate the types of data that was getting to them, and they allowed themselves to be spun in every which way. And as your U.S. Senator, I can assure you that I will take a preventive medicine approach, approach that recognizes the value of biodiversity, and an approach that brings the best skills possible of scientific analysis to a group which is woefully underrepresentative of people who have technical skills in the interpretation of data.
Okay. Everybody get a chance to comment on that. A quick question out here, Tony, and then we'll wrap up.
Hello, my name is Jim McDonough. I'm from Faribault. The question that I have is for all five candidates. What have you done in your professional career to promote diversity?
Okay. Who wants to start?
I'll start again.
I'll be glad to answer that. We have been, I think, at the forefront in our firm in promoting diversity. And I have spoken out on that issue in the legal profession, and I'll continue to speak out on that issue. It is absolutely essential. This country is made up, as we all know, of a very diverse people. And in fact, it's increasing in diversity, particularly here in Minnesota. And I think many of us have seen some of the letters to the editor regarding new immigrants in this country. Coming from an immigrant family, it is disappointing to me, and I'm trying to choose a word that is not too pejorative, disappointing to me that we see some of the things that have been said in Minnesota about the new diversity that we're facing in this state. Diversity enriches us. It enriches us in all aspects of our life. And I don't think there's anyone on this dais up here, on these tables, that would not support diversity.
Jim, this is David Lillehug. I want to thank you for your question, especially coming the day after we celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. And I was proud to join people in St. Cloud and St. Paul and Rochester at various events, including a wonderful one yesterday where Jesse Jackson spoke. As United States Attorney, I substantially changed the face of that federal office. When I walked in the door, there were hardly any people of color in attorney positions. When I left, more than 20% of the attorneys were people of color. Women were promoted, including a lesbian woman, to supervisory positions in the criminal division where that had never happened before. So my commitment to diversity is very strong, but I'm proudest probably of co-convening the Minnesota Summit on Hate Crimes. And certainly when we have seen what happened to Matthew Shepard in Wyoming and what happened in Texas and so on, opposition to hate crimes just has to be fundamental because everyone should be feel free to walk around the street, engage in all kinds of activities without fear of violence. And I will fight hate crimes in the United States Senate.
This is Steve Miles. In 1985, the AMA passed a rule saying that doctors could refuse to treat HIV-infected patients. I found their 1847 code. We published it. They changed. I came out against homophobia with regard to the Defense of Marriage Act. With regard to the medical school, when they were enrolling and graduating 1 to 20 ratio of my students of color relative to what should be doing, I challenged them in the Star Tribune, which made me very uncomfortable with the administration of the school. I have put my life on the line in Cambodia and in Bosnia and supported refugee relief for 20 years. I'm a PAGE mentor, PAGE Foundation mentor to students of color. We have taken a Cambodian person into our home who came from that shell-shocked land and put him through college. He is now a nurse living in the city. I've worked with a number of major organizations throughout the Twin Cities serving people of color from the African, the Asian, and the Indian communities to make those organizations stronger, helping them not just financially, but working with them to help write their reports and make those reports better. Okay. I am entirely committed to building a stronger, more diverse nation, and will not only do that at arm's length, but have shown that I'm willing to bring it right into the center of my house.
Okay, minute-long comment for
each
of
you. Yep, I want to thank you for the question, too. Yesterday, think about yesterday and Martin Luther King Day, and then think about Rod Grams, and then think about Humphrey Mondale,
McCarthy, Wellstone. Over the last, in my career, I've been fortunate to be part of, in St. Louis County, putting in the first beds for HIV, in the state Senate, being part of a co-author on the human rights bill, and in education, bills that would put more help into our schools to help educate our children. And those are the kinds of things that I believe will make me a good U.S. Senator.
Okay. Senator Kelly?
I think any of us who've served in the Minnesota House and Minnesota Senate could point to a number of things, but one of the proudest days of my service in the House was when I voted and we passed the amendments to the Minnesota Human Rights Act that added gays and lesbians to the groups protected by that act. And I voted against including the Defense of Marriage Act in the tax bill, which was a crazy idea sponsored on the floor of the Senate by one of the Republicans. The thing I would like most, though, to point to is that I think the important thing is to empower people to succeed in this economy, in this society, and that's why I fought for microenterprise loans and technical assistance so that women and people of color could start their own businesses and really realize the American dream through owning their own businesses. And I had the chance to visit El Mercado Central in Minneapolis recently and see business owners who had benefited from that bill.
All right, before we run out of time here, we do want to give each of the candidates 2 minutes to make their pitch for your support. Sorry, we don't have more time here for more questions. Each of the candidates will get 2 minutes, and might as well start here and work our way this way, I guess. Dr. Miles?
Yeah, I think one of the lovely things about Minnesota is you look at this field, all of us are well qualified to the U.S. Senate, and frankly, any one of us would be a better senator than Mr. Rod Grams, who puts ideology ahead of people. So go to your precinct caucuses. My campaign will be based on health care. Everybody has to have comprehensive health care all the time from a position of their choice. It can't tie them to work. We must have a program of lifelong education. Older workers should not be downsized by new technologies. It's incentives early retirement. It cuts their wages, decreases their ability to save for retirement, it hurts our national productivity. We need a GI Bill for lifelong education, and the United States is in the bottom third of all developed nations in the amount that it spends on post-secondary education for older workers. We need to save Social Security. Now, all of us will hold these positions because we're all Democrats, with the exception of one Democrat, not at this table, who supports ending Social Security. But I will say this, when look at the experience that the candidate brings to those issues. I was on Clinton's health care plan. I was in President of Minnesotans for Affordable Health Care to bring in Minnesota Care. I'm a geriatrician. I've worked on Social Security reform, and I've taught for 25 years. These are diverse skills, and the choices that you have to make is not just who's best qualified, but who can best fill out the missing skills in the Senate, because the Senate is not diverse. It's not diverse by skills. We need scientists in the Senate. We need physicians in the Senate. We need teachers in the Senate. And we also need people from all slices of society in the Senate. Thank you.
University of Minnesota physician Steve Miles. Former U.S. Attorney David Lillehog, you go next, please.
We need a new senator who will work for Minnesotans, not an extreme right-wing agenda. And I'm tired of Rod Grams' extremism canceling out Minnesota's voice in the United States Senate, and that's why I'm running. To beat him, we need 2 things. First, we need fresh, progressive DFL leadership. And I'm running on the concept of people's economics, the idea that bigger is not always better, even in the global economy. And as you've heard tonight, I'm opposed to the disturbing rush toward consolidation in so many of our key industries. As we've seen at the airports in Minnesota, when you've got a monopoly, prices go up, service goes down, working people get the shaft. And we've got to stand up for family farmers in the state, and I commend Senator Wellstone and Congressman Mingy for calling for an 18-month moratorium in agriculture mergers. Number 2, we need the kind of campaign that can excite and energize everyone at the grassroots. And one thing that really pleases me a lot is how many young people are getting involved in my campaign. You can tell from the audience tonight that we're really connecting with young people around the state, and that's something the DFL party has not done all that well in the past. We're connecting with them on issues of diversity and the environment and student loans and other issues that are, should be of concern to all Minnesotans. To beat Rod Graham's, we need the best grassroots campaign this state has seen. I am absolutely committed to doing that. We have the resources to do it. We're connecting with young people and others to do it. And I'll tell you, I've really got the fire in the belly to take on and beat Rod Graham's, and I would love to have your support. Thank you very much.
Former U.S. Attorney David Littlehaug, and next up, State Senator Steve Kelly.
I want to first thank Congressman Mingy for sponsoring this event. He's a terrific representative for the state and for the 2nd District in Congress, and we're lucky to have him. I want to thank NPR and Bethany College and the DFL also for sponsoring this. I'm going to work hard for the DFL endorsement. And I think, as Congressman Mingy said, it's very important that our party select a candidate as soon as possible. And if I get the DFL endorsement, I'm going to be making that case. So I want every DFLer to know today that I will abide by the DFL endorsement. I will not run against the DFL-endorsed candidate. I expect to be the DFL-endorsed candidate. But I'm really excited about this race, because there is so much potential in this country today for kids to succeed, for all kinds of people to succeed. We have to make sure that we're adopting policies in Congress that reinvest in this country, that keep this expansion going, because this expansion is what's creating so many opportunities for people. In the course of that, though, we have to make sure, and we need a U.S. Senator committed to making sure that no one gets left behind in this process, whether you live in a rural community or in the center city, whether you are a rural community or a center city neighborhood. You have to know that you will not be left behind, that the United States still stands for hope, for opportunity and success for everybody in this country, not just for a few. And I'd appreciate your support.
State Senator Steve Kelly, and next we're going to hear from State Senator Jerry Janicich.
I'm State Senator Jerry Janicich. Rod Graham's is in the majority, and he's failed us. Our Minnesota and our country should not have dairy policies that are older than I am. Our Minnesota and our country should give more than rhetoric to the family farm. Our Minnesota and our country should have an active role in housing. Our Minnesota and our country should make Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid promises we gave to our seniors whole. Our Minnesota and our country should bring early childhood education to the forefront. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. We gave no value to her. Today, we have women working for our, with our children as we drop them off to daycare, Head Start, early childhood, and we still give them no value. Our Minnesota and our country should access and make sure that public education is what we're all about. Our Minnesota and our country should make free trade fair trade. Rod Graham's has not done that. And as your senator, 6 years from now, if I'm as inept as he is, send me home too, like I intend to send him home.
State Senator Jerry Janicich, and finally, Attorney Michael Cerisi.
Thank you, Gary. I'd like to thank Representative Mingy, Bethany College, and NPR for hosting this function this evening. We face, in this election, once again a watershed year in American politics, because the issue really is between two competing principles. Number one, the Republicans advanced this one: give me my money back, I want a tax cut. On the other side is this: are we willing as a people to reinvest
in each other, to reinvest in America. Is Senator Graham's known as the education senator? Is Senator Graham's known as the health senator? Is Senator Graham's known as the farm senator? No. Does he lead anything? No. Minnesota is entitled to effective advocacy, strong advocacy, and I will give you that. I have already done that for the state of Minnesota. And I will continue to do that for the state of Minnesota in the Senate. I will be known as the education senator and the health senator and the farm senator. I will work with the Democratic majority in preserving Social Security and Medicare. And I will work for education at the top priority, because it is education that enables people to move up the economic ladder. It is education that enables people to achieve their maximum potential. I ask for your support. I can be the most effective advocate. And skills are advocacy in the United States Senate. Thank you very much.
That was Attorney Michael Cerisi. My personal thanks to all of the candidates for showing up, and matter of fact, for all the candidates in all the parties who are running. It's always easy to snipe and complain, but it's quite another thing to step forward and run around the state of Minnesota and explain yourself and the issues. Thank you very much for your effort. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes our DFL Senate debate this evening. Tonight's discussion was sponsored by the Minnesota DFL Congressional Delegation and the Minnesota DFL Party. Minnesota Democrats will be holding their precinct caucuses on the weekend of March 11th. Republicans and Reformers will hold their caucuses on Tuesday, March 7th. If you missed part of this evening's DFL debate, we'll be rebroadcasting it tomorrow, starting at 11 on our midday program. And, of course, you can count on continuing coverage of the U.S. Senate race right on through Election Day here on Minnesota Public Radio. Sarah Meyer was the producer of this evening's broadcast. Kara Figenshue was our assistant producer. Will Hadland and Tony Bowl from Minnesota Public Radio's Public Affairs Department helped organize tonight's debate. Tony and Len Witt handled our questions here at the theater. Our engineers here in Mankato were Alan Strickland and Clifford Bentley. Studio engineer in St. Paul was Steve Griffith. And also our thanks to the folks here at Bethany for their hospitality. Again, thanks so much for joining us from the Ilva Soccer Fine Arts Center on the campus of Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. I'm Gary Eichten. Good evening.